We're all happy to be back again with a new addition to my family yesterday.
Oh, another Mazel Tov.
Thank you. I had the privilege.
You get one of these every week, I think.
Not quite. Being the son that got my newest great-grandson.
How many you got? Great.
I have 13 great-grandchildren right
now.
Yeah. Yeah. Damn horror.
Did it happen 2 weeks ago?
Well, this is the one a week ago.
Oh.
Yeah, it was born a week ago. On Christmas, yesterday.
Any others on the way right now, you know?
Not to my knowledge, okay. They'll let me know, I'm sure. So we shall see. All right, so tonight is the 22nd of January in the year 2003. I'm going to summarize briefly what we learned last week, because unfortunately the machine wasn't working properly, but at the same time I like to cover new ground always, whenever we meet. So, all right, there is a mission now at the bottom of 28A. Okay, we don't have it over here. I'll do it orally, okay? The Mishnah there says, V'yodama Rav Yehuda, another statement of Rav Yehuda was that Beis HaKnesses Shechorav, if a shul has become a ruin, Ein Maspidim Misocho, it says they're not allowed to make a hesped in it, in other words, not allowed to conduct a funeral eulogy in it, V'yein Afshilim Misoche Chavolim, V'yein Prosim Misoche Metzudas, V'yein Shotchen Agavi Peros. And there are certain things that they're allowed to do, in other words, to make a non-holy use of the shul, as for example, not to put together ropes in there, not to spread nets in it, not to take fruit and let it dry on its roof. In other words, you're using it for a purpose which is not a holy purpose. You have to show respect even if the shul itself lies in ruins, but you have to have respect for it. And then it says also, you're not allowed to make it into a shortcut. And the verse in the Torah which shows that this is the way we are to behave towards a synagogue, which even though it is ruined, is Shenema. The Pasuk says, it says, which means literally, I will lay waste your sanctuaries. Doesn't say Mikdashim, but says Mikdash Sheichem, which means the plural, your sanctuaries. And it is interpreted, Kedusha Son, they are still holy, Afshehein Shomimim, even though they lie desolate now. And then the Mishnah continued by saying, Olu Boyasovim, that if grass grows in it, Lo Yisloish Bifnei Akmas Nefesh, you should not pull out the grass in order that you should experience sorrow, that this is what has happened to a shul, that it's now a ruin, and grass has been permitted to grow wild in it. Okay, so this is what the Mishnah says, and I'll summarize very briefly what we learned last week in connection with the Mishnah. We had at the very bottom of Chof Ches Oman Aleph a very important principle which applies to these things. It says, Tanur Rabbanan, our sages taught us that that in a synagogue you're not allowed to behave literally with levity. In other words, you should be serious when you come into a shul. You're there for the purpose of davening, of communicating with the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, and so therefore you should not treat it with levity. You should take it seriously. And some things we said, Einoichon Behen, and Shesu Behen, you're not allowed to eat in it, you're not allowed to drink in it, but here we are again on Chof Ches Omen Beis, okay? Yede Yosu Behen, you're not allowed to farput yourself, in other words. Right, okay. Don't adorn yourself over there, right? Yede Matilim Behen, and Reima Tyler Mehem, excuse me, not allowed to use it as a place just to take a walk up and down.
So in other words, you're telling me that if somebody walking back and forth here, like some people I know, that's not allowed.
If they're davening, it's allowed.
Why
if they're only
promenading, it doesn't say that. No.
No, I know it.
It doesn't say that.
I know it. I know it. But, you know, some people are so full of energy.
You can't go for a
right.
Pasir.
Right. The Gemara in Brochus mentions, I think, about Rabbi Akiva, that he would stand over here and daven, and the first thing you know, he was over there. I mean, it's, you know, doing davening, he was concentrating, and he just had to walk back and forth in order to be able to do it. So that's why I say,
well,
all right,
had
a person.
He had a shul of everybody walking in different directions all the time.
Well, if they're walking at cross purposes, then that's not good.
I'm sorry?
So if they are walking at cross purposes, then that's
well,
not good.
Well, they're davening, so, I mean,
right.
According to you,
but,
they,
we know, when their Kahan comes
that's
over
right.
here, for example, right.
That's
so,
one.
He walks up and down, up and down. So. Okay. All right, I forgive him as long as I know he's not.
Nobody makes a million, right?
Yeah, but the basis over here, I mean, the
I
idea is right.
Understand.
I mean, that, you know, it's not nice to use it simply as a place, you know, to walk back and forth. Okay. The Einich Nosa Behem Achama, remember, and you're not allowed to come into it if it's a hot day, hot sunny day, but the Achama because of the sun. Or the Akshamim, if it's a rainy day, don't come in, you know, into the Akshamim because of the rain. In other words, don't come in except if you're serious for davening. Don't show disrespect simply to make it as an umbrella or something like that, okay? The Eimas Binim Behem Hesped Shel Yochid. Nor are we allowed to make eulogies in it for an individual, okay? And of course, these are going to be explained tonight as we continue with the Gemara, including the new Gemara. About Kohen Bohen, what should you use the synagogue for besides davening? You should study Torah in it, Mishonin Bohen, study Mishnah, right? And also it says, Maspinin Bohen Hesped Shel Rabin. And also, you are allowed to make eulogies there if it is something that affects the entire community. And Omar Rav Yehuda, so Rav Yehuda said, these things that we said you're not allowed to do in the shul, he said, hey, what's I when? He says, be yeshuvan. This is as long as the shul is still being used, people are still using it. However, if the shul lies in ruins, so nevertheless, manichin otson, liolin bahim otson, in that case, let the grass alone, and let the grass grow in it, as we said, as the Mishnah said, nor should you pluck the grass from it, pull the grass from it, in order to show how sad you are that it lies in ruins. So then the Gemara said, where did the mention of grass ever show up over there? There's no mention made, and yet the Mishnah comes and quotes about grass. So he says, Betsurim Metzurim. He says, well, what happened is that we have to supply what is missing. V'hochi katanim. Learn, rather, that the Mishnah should read as follows. U'mechab dinoison. You should sweep a shul, which of course is what? Which is in use. Okay? U'mabitzin oson. And also it says that you should also clean the floors by pouring water on it, picking up the dust and so on, k'deisha lo yelavehin ha'salim, in order to prevent grass from going in there. But obviously we're talking not about a shul which is ruined, we're
talking
about a shul which
shul.
Is in use, and as I pointed out, they didn't have, as a normal rule, floors in shuls in those days, although I did mention last week that nevertheless there are shuls in Israel where we could see mosaic floors, and some very famous ones, okay, like the shul in Beit She'an, and shuls, some other shuls. Yeah, Kfar Nachum, right. Which was the original name. Kapanag. Of course, unfortunately, the church took over that one. You had the Franciscan one. Sipori, too, they have. Yeah, there are several places where you find it.
Can I just ask you?
Sure.
Umar, always thought my beats was to beat.
There are different meanings to the word. And Yitzhak Hashem tonight will learn another one. The Harbitz Torah doesn't mean to be Torah, but it means to spread Torah, propagate Torah.
Right.
So, it all depends what it is. But here, Rashi explains it in the sense, that Marbitzim is what it today sort of would be called using the sponge.
For those of you who are not Israelis, so have been in Israel, Sponger is a great institution. It means that every Erev Shabbos and Yontav, you pour water on the floor, and then you have what I call a sponger. A sponger is, it's a mop that you use in order to clean the floors.
Of course.
Stone floors very often. Yeah. Jewish life, you have stone floors. Yeah. So this is an institution. So it's the same idea. Use a sponge on the floor. So in order to keep the dust down and making it also, as we said, not to allow the grass to grow. Okay. So this is what the Gemara said so far. And in addition, it says, Rabasi said, well, taking a social but Mobile, he said, the shuls in Babylonia said, Al Tanai Hinasu. They are built on a condition. Now, what is the condition? The condition, as we learned from Rashi, is the fact that they look forward to the day when all the shuls, and we'll learn this tonight too, when all the shuls in Eretz Yisrael, when all the shuls that are outside of Israel, particularly the shuls in Babylonia, because this is what they were talking about over here, will be moved to Eretz Yisrael. Okay? So therefore, their synagogues are built on a condition, of course being that if, let's say, people move out of the neighborhood or something like that, and it's no longer able to be kept up, so in that case, the Kedusha that is in the synagogue is not necessarily to remain permanently over there. Whereas in Eretz Yisrael, a shul which is built should have a permanent Kedusha. Okay? Even the Churbanon has been learned, even if they are destroyed. Okay? Hi. How are you, Greg? Good. All right. Then the Gemara continues. It says, nevertheless, even though they are not built, in other words, as permanent synagogues, but they are built upon condition that, should circumstances change, that they can be sold. But nevertheless, as long as the shul is in existence, even in Babylonia, in Nohagin Mohen Kalas Rosh. Okay? And you're not allowed to behave with levity in there. In other words, be serious over there. And then the Gemara says, for example, give me an example. It says, Cheshbonos. In other words, you're not allowed to do all kinds of figuring, calculations, and so on. In other words, like figure out the batting averages, the stock market, how did you make out in the last business deal, and so on. No. Shul should be there for the important purpose of davening. Omar, yes?
We shouldn't be doing, financial meetings with
the board of directors. No, obviously, right. Obviously, a shul still needs financial support. So we're not arguing about that. But we're arguing about something rather, which is, like I pointed out, why did I say stock market and so on. Even if they didn't have a stock market in those days. But the point is that I wanted to make is simply, not to indulge in the kind of idle chatter that I hear in shul sometimes. Batting averages, did the stocks go up and down, and stuff of that nature, and so on and so forth. Which has nothing to do, in other words, with the financing of the shul itself.
Secular things,
right. This is what we're talking about. And then Rabasi says, Beisach Nesesh Mechash Bechesh Veinais. He says, if this is the way you act in the shul, but you're doing this kind of calculations, then Malinin Boyes Hameis. And you're going to bring about that a mace, in other words, a dead body, is going to lie in the shul. Well, that's kind of a strong statement. So they say, Malinin Salkadaki. What do you mean that this is going to happen? He says, Lo Sagi, the Lat Hochi, Ella Soshi, Alinabo Mace Mitzvah. In other words,
it's
not bad enough. It's not enough, you know, that, you know, you shouldn't be doing these things, but you know what will happen. One of these days, a mesbitz will die, and then everybody will have to be busy burying the mesbitz. Remember again, mesbitz is somebody who dies and there's nobody to take care of him. Then in that case, it is considered the biggest mitzvah that we could do, because it means that we don't even perform other mitzvahs until we have taken care of this mitzvah. Okay? And then they try to define what is the enes and the osin by hen. What do we mean by that? That, you know, they're not allowed to fix their hair and put on cosmetics and stuff like that in the shul. He says, Kachomim etalmidehem utoran. He says, for the sages and his disciples, they can do it. Why? Because they're there all day long, so obviously there may be times when they have to do something like this. But for the ordinary person who only drops into the shul for an hour or a half hour, whatever it may be, this is not right. Okay. The Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, as Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi said, my Bei Rabbanan. He says, what do we mean by the expression Bei Rabbanan? It means based on the Rabbanan. In other words, the shul should be a place where our rabbis, our teachers, and our sages come for serious purposes to study and to learn. And this should be, so to speak, their primary home. Not the place where their family is, but this is where they should spend their time, the major part of their day. I don't have to tell you not everybody is capable of doing it, but you understand on the basis of this, what is the attitude towards learning in Meridian Yeshivas, where people talk to come in the morning and they stay all night even. I mean, I've been in shuls, you know, where 10, 11 o'clock at night people are coming in order to learn. Springfield, I don't think we would find it. But you can find it in Yerushalayim, you can find it in New York in certain sections and so on. Yes.
On the other hand, we had someone come into the show recently, give a talk, and they were stating that having choleo is not necessarily the most accepted part of our tradition. As during these days, throughout the history of the Jewish people,
Kolel did
not necessarily
fit encouraged. Yeah, this is true. I mean, you know, if you were to take the attitude of the Pirkei Avos, for example, where it says, Yofet Hamatum Derecheret, right? Which means that the study of Torah is fine when it's combined with a worldly occupation. So obviously, even the great sages of the Talmud, who spent many, many hours learning Torah, but nevertheless, they also had to go out and make a living as well. So that this is what they were praised for. This one was a sadler, in other words, a shoemaker. Another one was Barnabka, he was a smithy, you know, blacksmith, and so on and so forth. And we find, for example, Rav Kana says, you know, don't seek to be called Kana Rabba, in other words, you know, the great Kohen, but rather, if necessary, for Shabbos, and rely upon people to supply you with your needs for Shabbos, but go out and take a lowly occupation, even such as skinning an animal, for the sake of the hide or something like that, you know, to sell the hide or to tan it and so on and so forth. But don't rely upon people. Earn your own living. So, it's true. I wish that, you know, some of the Kollel mentioned would realize that you really have to combine the study of Torah together with that. But on the other hand, many yeshivas today have encouraged Jungerite, as we would say, you know, to sit in Kollel. And the question is, when do they get out of Kollel and begin, you know, to try to make a living doing whatever it may be? Could be in teaching, could be in Rabbanis, or it could be in anything other than that. You know, Baruch Hashem, we have many, many people who have earned smicha, and yet, you know, they don't live on the basis of the smicha. They go out and they go into all kinds of occupations and live a life of Torah and mitzvah's dedication while at the same time, you know, going in and earning a living.
But isn't the whole purpose of studying to be able to sanctify the mundane?
It certainly should be.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Because without the one, you don't have the other.
Yeah.
You know.
I agree.
Yeah, it's a reciprocal relationship.
Right. And
yet, well,
should be.
Should be. Then get popularized.
It became popular, I would say, primarily about the 18th, 19th century. But nevertheless, I mean, I'm sure that there were, even at an earlier time, you know, that you had people who would sit, you know, many, many hours every day. The Vildegon, for example, is supposed to have slept only 4 hours every night. The rest of the time, he devoted to Torah and to, you know, to prayer. Okay, he was a Vildegon, a great genius. He made a joke one time. Somebody said that there is a posuk in the book of Job, where Job says, Yashabti oz yaduachli. Yashabti oz, then I would have slept and I would have had rest, right? Okay. So, a popular interpretation of Yashabti oz alav zayin, you know, which means now or then, Aleph is 1, Zion is 7, so add them together, what do we have? We have 8. So in other words, you should study, you should learn, let's say, 14 hours a day and sleep, my arithmetic is about 16 hours, okay? So, all right. But sleep 8 hours at night, right? So they said, well, there we go. Look, how come you're not doing it? So he said, I am fulfilling it. Since you shall be us, you do have me. The odds means 4 hours this night and 4 hours the next night. That makes up the 8 hours. All right.
It's interesting that Rambam refused to make wing of Rabbonis, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. He speaks very vehemently, as a matter of fact, about the people who go around asking for the dovas, for yeshivas. And he says, look, take a look at all the people, the great Talmidei Chachamim of ancient times, who worked to earn a living at the same time, you know, they devoted their entire life also to Torah learning and so on. So why shouldn't we be following their example? And he really was very angry in this. If you want to know where the source is, you'll find it in the Rambam's commentary to Pirkei Avos. Yeah. Yes.
I think there's a story about Vilna Gaon. His sister came to see him, who he hadn't seen in years, and he talked to her for maybe a few minutes and then showed her out and said, you know, basically, I don't have time to see you in this life. So what is that?
So what shall I say? He's a Vildegon. Not everybody behaves that way. There are some great Rabbanim in America, also great Rabbanim. I'm not sure that they have time for their family as well. What can I tell you?
Is there any way to call that right?
Yeah, well, all right, what shall I say? All right. Then, yes. Okay. Then, of course, as to the part of the Mishnah which says that, rather, it's Baraisa, which says that you should not go into the shul, yeah, it's the Mishnah, not to enter the shul if it's a hot day in order to escape the heat, or on a rainy day to escape the rain. So they gave the example, Kihoda Rabina Rabota Baramasta, he says, Hava Kayami, remember that they were standing with Sharla Shailta the Rova. They were asking the Sharla Rova. So also Zilka, the Mitra, so all of a sudden there came a heavy downpour. So idly lay the vacation. They came, so they went into the shul. So Amri, so they said, Hi the Ayalina the Vekanishna, he says, the fact that we're going into the shul, it's not mishum mitra, it's not because of the rain. Ela mishum nishmata. Right? Because we need, you know, to continue this discussion and learn the Torah that Rava had to teach us, okay? But silusa biyomo, istana. And, you know, we need, in a day when the question is, what is istana? I think you said that some kind of a wind. According to the side note over here, if you take a look, we because they were a little puzzled as to what the word meant. So they said, it is Ruach Tzifonis. Okay, if it is, it's a wind coming from the north, and apparently it's a very strong and, not not a gentle wind, okay? So in that particular case, then we have to come in and, in order to carry on our Torah discussion, but not to come in again simply in order to come in out of the rain or out of the wind or whatever it may be, but to come in order to daven. So Amalei Rav Acha Bereidu Oven Rav Ashi. So Rav Acha, the son of Rav, said to Rav Ashi, "It's the Rich Leila Inish." He says, "When I need somebody, so and I have to the Mikre Gavra and Beknishta, I have to go and call somebody who's at the moment in Shul. My, how shall I do it?" So Amalei, so he answered him, "Itzuvid Marbodenhu." If he happens to be a Talmud Chochem, a young Torah scholar, then Leimoy Hilchasa, then come in, give him a halacha, teach him a teaching of Torah, right? The Tanahu Leimah Masnisa, and or if he's a student of Mishnah, give him a Mishnah. The Akarahu, or if he is a student of Bible, of Torah, Bible in this case, right? So Leimah Psuka, then mention a verse to him. In other words, come in and approach him with a question about whatever Torah that you know that he's capable of answering. The Imlo, and if you know that this person does not have the ability in any of these subject areas, and you still need him, so in that case, Leimo Leimo Yanuka, go and tell a child, says, Eimo Li Psukecha, tell me what pasuk are you learning? Right, so that there was still a there's still a moment of Torah discussion. It's not coming in just in order to get hold of this guy. Or Inami says, or if you wish, another possibility is simply Nishtei Puto, stay for them while in Shul Benekim, and then after that you can go out with him. Okay, all right. So here is the new material that we start tonight. Mishnah mentioned in Maspidin Bohen Hespin Shol Rabin that in a shul we learned that you cannot do it for a Hespin Shol Yochid, right? Not for an individual, but for something that affects the Rabin, that affects the community. So now that needs definition too. So they begin by saying, okay, Heichid Domi, that's what that Hey Dalit means. Give me an example, he says, of Hespeda the Rabbin. Okay. What do we mean by that? So Mechava Rav Chista, so Rav Chista pointed and he said, Kigon Hespeda the Kaibe Rav Sheshes. For example, if Rav Sheshes is present over there, then in that particular case, it would be permissible to make a funeral or levaya in the shul itself. So Mechava Rav Sheshes, so Rav Sheshes at the same time pointed and he said, Kigon Hespeda the Kaibe Rav Chista. Okay? That's for example a place, where Rav Chista is, that would be a Hespeda the Rav. Okay. Raphrom Hespeda Kalosi. Now we have a case where Raphrom made a Hesped for his daughter in law, the Bei Kedishta, in the shul. Okay? So Omar, so what was his excuse? He says, Mishum Yikor Didi, right? Udamisa, also Kuleyalma. He says, in order to show honor unto me, and also to honor the dead person, right, the dead woman, this is why everybody comes. So in other words, he says, for someone, who was a great member of the family, in order to show me, so this would be permissible, okay? Yes.
I must have missed this last week. You're saying that a chesed should not be said for the regular person in a basement.
That is correct. That's what it said, a yochid, right. But if it's a person who is important in a community, then they might overrule it by saying, it's a chesed shall rob it.
Okay, so they're using these examples of various rabbis.
That is correct.
Example,
right.
Important people.
Yes.
Can you make?
But we're not saying that, you know, it's only for a Levi of an important person. It's a Levi even where these are present. So in order to show honor to the person over there, whether they actually got up to make a hesped or not, I can't answer that, because it doesn't you know, say that. But obviously, Rabbonim did make this payment, because the Gemara in the Moed Katan, we have several examples of that.
But
yeah.
I suppose you could then continue the thought and say that, except for these particular examples,
right.
Not allowed.
No. That is correct. It's a normal rule. Yeah.
So why are there funerals and shuls that include?
Well, are we talking about shuls or temples now?
Or anything.
Yeah. The question is, does this fall under the business of Shel Rabim? In order to show honor to somebody who has been a tremendous service to the community, to the shul, in that case, we could find some excuse for it.
Okay, so this is where you would...
Yeah, this is that. Right. Right. This would be a source for that, for justification.
Doctor, think about Rob Hista.
Right.
Kind of are they saying
Rob
that...
Chasius, yeah.
Are they saying that when, if these men were to decease, or are they saying where they're part, sort of part of the congregation where someone else has died, but
yeah.
allowed to do a hespa because they're important?
Okay. Apparently, the answer to the question that was raised, you know, hey, Chidami, give me an example. So they said, okay, for example, if either he was there, he was there, present over there, then in that particular case it come out in order to show honor to him as well as to the dead person.
Okay.
Okay. Doesn't happen too often, but of course it's obvious that if a great rod, a great teacher or somebody like that passes away, then obviously it's going to be in the shul or in the yeshiva or something like that. I remember, for example, you know, Rav Shekhov, one of the children passed away. Or Moshe Feinstein, or going back in the history of Kadima when Rabbi Pollack passed away, and so obviously everybody came in order to show honor over here. Okay.
So when we build the third Beis HaMikdash, this practice should go away.
No, it doesn't. Beis HaMikdash? We're not talking about the Beis HaMikdash. Beis HaMikdash is a different story.
No, I understand, but I mean, in the same building there could be Kahanim who can be ritually.
Well, this already is a different problem that you raised. It's obvious that a Kohen is not allowed to be under the same roof,
right,
together with it. Now, if it could be sealed off in some way or other, but you have a mechitza between the dead person and maybe a separate ceiling or something. I understand that sometimes in Europe they would build, very often they would do it on the cemetery. They had a house over there, you know, like we still have in the old cemeteries over here. And they would perform the tar over there. So for the Kahanim, they had like a different space so that it would be under a different roof or something like that. Yeah.
One of our closest friends, relatives, the Holocaust survivors, she passed away a few weeks ago in Hartford.
Yeah.
And we went to...
Go to Sachem Shul? No, there I saw something I've never seen before.
No, this was the old shul, right, North Main Street. Achavat Achim, I think.
I go to Sachem. Well, I said, I go to Sachem.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah. So, what they did, they... raised the casket to the level of the ark, but on the other side of the building where they had the glass wall.
Yeah, they put a glass wall over there, and the mess is there, right.
Inside,
it's considered
the
being
casket
outside. Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I saw it. So, okay. Somebody came up with a very ingenious idea from that point of view.
What did they do? I don't follow
it. The sanctuary, the Guru Sahin, okay. I saw it with Solovine's wife. Passed away. The funeral was held over there, and then they brought the body over here to Kadima. Yeah. So, at any rate, let's say this is the shul over here, right? And here's the Oren Kodesh, right? The platform, etc. Right over here, they have some kind of a glass wall, and they place the body behind over there. So apparently it's built separately, whichever way it is. I'm not quite sure how they worked it out, you know, but it's there in any case. So the body rested behind there, and obviously the glass was a separation from the shul itself. And that way, you know, they had the various hespedim given by the various rabbis who were present.
The machitza in Young Israel,
yeah,
in West Hartford, is also separated by a glass partition.
Yeah, but that would be between the men and the women.
Yeah, section, I know.
Right.
But,
yeah, correct.
But would they?
Yeah, but
see
this I've seen in several shuls, right? That you know, the women sit in the rear, but there's a glass partition over there, so that they can see all the activity that's going on. And you know, vice versa, the men can take a look and see whether the wives are there, whether the daughters came.
In Israel, they put the curtain.
Yes.
They close the curtain so you can't see whatever.
Right.
You don't know whether the arrow and it's open, closed.
That's already a Hasidic custom.
What is the purpose then of the glass mechitza?
The purpose of the glass mechitza, technically, the women are separate from the men, okay? But at the same time, it enables them to see what's going on and to know, you know, where the davening is and everything else. And, so it has a very practical purpose. I've seen it in quite a few shuls. Other shuls have a different arrangement. What they have is that they have, let's say, the middle section is for the men, and then the sides, they have it raised a little or something like that, so it's not on the same level, and then the women sit on the sides of the shul. So you have different ways of approaching it. Okay.
The Central Synagogue of Moscow has like two stories. The first story is for men.
Right.
Women.
Yeah, we'll probably have a balcony.
Yeah,
balcony. Yeah. No, Kadima used to have it back in the old building, right?
Yeah,
yeah, correct. Kesser had it, the Rosh Hashul had it, sure. And of course, the Rosh Hashul had a bima in the middle, I mean, right till the time that they had to close it down.
The bima in the middle was for Torah reading.
Correct.
That's a lot.
Right. Well, according to the Chassam Sofer, great authority, this is a kosher shul with the bima in it. He disliked heartily the innovation that was taking place at that time by the Reform, who made the bima in the front of the shul, because he felt it was an imitation of the goyim. It's not Jewish. And from the point of view of history, there's no question that it was part of the imitation of the goyish church that they did it. Today, well, you know, I'm not going to say that our shul is straight because of it, chas v'shalom, but it certainly is not in the original tradition of the synagogue which had a bima. Okay. Yeah, there's no question.
I wanted to ask you about the glass mechitza. My understanding would be that it would be in the back of the shul. It isn't like we would have it here. In other words, the men would sit in the front, then there would be a mechitza that would be glass, and the women would sit behind it so they could see the service.
Yeah, that's what the arrangement is.
Okay.
And also
so
to
say
they have the mechitza over here, so the men sit here, the women sit here.
So
yeah.
If the men wanted to, go and look at the women, which is an oddly, they really have to strain to do this. They have to turn around.
In Young Israel, you have to turn around.
Right.
Rough a little bit.
Okay. All right. So, getting back to our text. Okay. So, Raphram made a hesped for his daughter-in-law in the shul, and he said, "It's an honor. It's in my honor, and also of the dead woman that the people have come." Rab Zera Safte la Ruben Rabbon Veknishna. He made a hesped for a great rabbi in the shul, and Omar, and he said, Imishum Yikorati D, Imishum Yikorati Day, the Misa, Lotzel Kaliyam. People come to the Levaya in the shul, either in order to show honor to me, or to show honor also to him who is dead. Okay? Reish Lakish, Safte Lahu Tzuvu Rabbonin, he made a hesped for a young Torah scholar, the Shechich Biar de Israel, who literally was found in the land of Israel. In other words, he lived in the land of Israel. What about this young man? He says, the Havatani Hilchisa de Chavdalit Shirasa. He would teach halachas in the 24th row. Now, what does it mean, the 24th row? Either it means that he sat in the 24th row and people would gather around it, or it means that he had 24 rows of students who were listening to his his expounding on the Torah text. Okay? So, what was the subject of the hesped? Omar, so Reish Lakish said, Vai Chasva Ard Yisrael Gavar Rab, says, alas, Eretz Yisrael has lost a great man. Now, the point is that even though this man, you know, he was a young Torah scholar, and, you know, he taught halachas, wasn't necessarily, you know, a great teacher or something like that, but nevertheless, Reish Lakish had tremendous respect for him, and he wanted to make a hesped for him to show how much he appreciated whatever this young man was able to accomplish in life. That's fine. Now we have something, a different story, okay? So now they go on to a different story. This time, as we'll discover, this is in Babylonia. Okay? Ahuda Havetana Hilchesa Sifra Sifra Utesepa. We have a story about a young scholar who was very, very learned. He had studied halachas, in other words, Gemaras, let's say. He had studied the Sifra. The Sifra is the rabbinic medrash. It's a medrash halacha upon Sefer Vayikra. The Sifrei, which is a similar type of a halachic medrash, which is, teaches us various laws that we derive from Bamidbar and Devarim. And what was the hesped that he gave me? And so he said, Hai Tzana the Mali Sifra the Chaser. He says, well, I'm sorry that we are here in order to gather together, in order to mourn for a man who is like a basket full of books. Meaning what? Meaning that he didn't feel that he was a genuine scholar. Okay, so he gave him a second class hesped instead of, you know, calling him a great man, as what Shimon Ben as what Reish Lakish had said in Eretz Israel. Do you understand? So this leads us, by the way, today it's considered a compliment. I want you to know.
Basket
to be a basket full of.
Well, you could be learned.
Right, right.
Not being able to inspire others to convey it to another person.
Correct.
So
yeah.
It could be a not complete.
Yeah, well, that's the idea, as I say. I mean, this is why he behaved. But nevertheless, I'm telling you that today, if you call somebody to say that he's a son of willing to suffer, etc., etc., it means that he, you know, he's learned this, that, the other thing, and so on and so forth. Okay. So at any rate, they have to write. The Shachit. So this man passed away, right? Also, the Yom Rav Rab Nachman. So they came to Rab Nachman, who was one of the great Torah scholars in Babylonia, and they said to him, Lispedemar, would you please, you know, recite a hesped for him? So Omar, so he said, Heichen Lispedei, what kind of a hesped should I give for him? Hai Tzana de Mali Sofer, the Choser. Is that what you want me to say? You know, that he is a basket filled with books, you know, that is now missing. So the Gemara concludes and it says, Toh Hazima ben Takifi da Art Yisrael the Chassidi du Bodo. Says, take a look at the difference in attitude between those who are considered standoffish in Eretz Yisrael as compared to those who are considered the great Hasidim of Bavel. In other words, Reish Lakish was considered, you know, a person who didn't, he was not the most sociable type of a person, okay? Nevertheless, when they asked him to make a chesed, he didn't hesitate to praise the person and call him a Gavra Rabba, right? A great man. On the other hand, Rav Nachman, who had a reputation for being very pious, but nevertheless, you see the attitude that he displayed towards, this person whom they had asked him to recite a chesed for. Dismissed him as being simply a basket full of books, not as a Torah scholar. Okay, so we see that there's a difference between how one group behaves and how the other group behaves. Tanan Hossam, in Pirkei Avos, literally over there, we learn the Dishtamash Besoka Chamov, that if a person So in Pirkei Avos then we learn that Dishtamash Besoka Chamov, if a person uses the crown of Torah in order to advance himself, then he will fail, he will perish literally. Tani Reish Lakish, so Reish Lakish in commenting upon this Mishnah said, Zeham Nishtamesh B'mish Hashem HaLochis. This is a person who makes use of somebody who is a Torah scholar, which is the Kisvo Shel Torah. In other words, this is the crown of Torah, to learn, right? And to observe. The Yomar Ula said, Dishtamash Inish B'man D'Tani Arbo'o V'lo Dishtamesh B'man D'Mastri Arbo'o, he says. It is permitted, he says, to make use of a person. In other words, to ask somebody, you know, to do you some service, to do you a favor, even though he has learned, you know, four of the six orders of the Mishnah, but not to make use of someone who teaches. In other words, the teacher is on a higher category, and you should not make profane use, so to speak, of a teacher. So that's the teacher with respect. Kihoda Reish Lakish, as in the case that we, that the hell about Reish Lakish. Hava Azu B'Urcha, he was going on the way, Mota Urkama, the Maya, and he came to where there was like a pool of water, which, you know, prevented you from going, dry. So also Hahu Gavra, a certain person came along, and he saw a Reish Lakish, and Arkivi Akaspe. So he put him on his shoulders, right? The Karmelay, and that way he was able to bring him to the other side. So Omalay, so Reish Lakish says to the man, Kariso, in other words, have you studied Torah, Mikra, right? Omalay, Karina, yes, I have studied Torah. Taniso, did you study Mishnah? So he says, yeah, Tanina, I learned that too. Tanina, not only have I learned, but I've learned Arba'a Sidre Mishnah. I've learned the four major divisions of the Mishnah. Omalay, so Reish Lakish said to him, Pasalta Lecha Arba'a Turei. You know what? It's as if you have hewn for yourself four rows of mitzvah, so to speak, right? And here you have, and it's, you're such a scholar, and yet the Ta'anta Bar Lakish Akaspech, you carry Bar Lakish, the son of Reish Lakish, upon your shoulders. Says Shadi Bei Lakisha B'maya, throw me into the water, he says. Throw Reish Lakish into the water. Throw me into the water. Omalei. So the man said to him, Nichali Dashbin in the Mar, says, I would rather, he says, learn something from you. So, but like I said, if that's the case, Gemormini or Milsa. So, okay, then learn from me something that I learned, Domer Rab Zera, that Rabbi Zera said, Benos Yisrael hein hechmir atzbon, shafil arroz tipos dam kechardol, yoshvus alov shivanakiyam. He gave him a halacha, and he told him, Rab Zera said that the daughters of Israel, in other words, Jewish women, they were the ones who were even more machmir upon themselves, they were even stricter with themselves than what the Torah demanded of them. Shafila roos tipas dam kechadol. They saw a drop of blood, which is no bigger than a mustard seed. Yoshua salov shivadakim. Then they have to observe 7 days of cleanliness following it before they can, you know, go into the mikveh and have relations with their husbands. So the women were the ones who urged this, who pushed this, that they wanted to be even stricter upon themselves than, as I say, what the Torah itself has to say. And that being the case, Tona de Eliyahu, and this you may find in the Siddur between Enkel Aheinu and Omer Rabbi Elazar, says, we have learned a tradition in the school of Eliyahu. It says, Kol Hashena Halacha is Muftach Lo Shehu Ben Olam Haba. Whoever studies halacha, he can be sure that he is a person who is destined for the world to come. Shenemar, how do we know this? We have a pasuk. Pasuk says, "Halichas Olam Loi," that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam is the one who guides the various goings about in the world. Whatever is going about is what halicha means. In other words, the noun that comes from the word holich, what's going on, right? But he says, "Al tirkei halichas," for the sake of to learn a lesson, don't read the word as halichas, ela halachas. Read it rather as halachas. In other words, halachas. If you learn halachas, then what? Olam lo. You get olam haba for that. Okay. All right. I think I shall stop at this point because next week, then the Mitzvah Hashem will continue with Ochtes. And my voice is running out in any case, so appreciate everybody coming out, and in spite of this terrible cold, but we should continue to come and to learn Torah. All right. Tonight is I'm losing track of time, I think the 29th already, right? Hey, the 29th of January, the year 2003. We are about to begin Daf Chof Tes, Omer Aleph, in Maseches Megillah. There's just an abbreviation left from the end of the previous page, which is Tonu Rabbanan. Our sages taught us as follows. All right, and now we're going to quote the Kof Tes Amud Aleph. What quotation are they talking about? It says, Mevatlin Talmud Torah, that's what that Taf means over there, Mevatlin Talmud Torah L'Hatzos HaMeis V'L'Hachnos Eskala. We are permitted to put aside the study of Torah in order either to accompany a dead person or to escort a kala. What do we mean by escorting a kala? So Rashi explains, he says, L'laveso mebeso viho leveso chupasa. In those days, the kala, of course, stayed with her own family until the time had come for her to stand under the chuppah and begin living with her husband. So they would escort her from the house, you know, where she lived with her parents to the place where the wedding was going to take place. So in order to show honor to the bride, therefore it was permitted for a Talmud Chacham to put aside his learning temporarily in order to fulfill the mitzvah of escorting the bride. And of course this leads us in general, to the idea of the Sameach Chosin Akala, that you want to make happy the Chosin and the Kala. You want to share in their joy and make them happy by your presence as well and taking part in their Siddur. Okay? And of course, as far as a dead person is concerned, we know that it is a big mitzvah to attend a Levaya, which is the Yiddish version of the Halvoya, which is the more correct Hebrew version, okay, and to escort the dead body to the place where he's going to be buried. So far we have something which is easy enough to understand. And then they bring an example. They said, they said concerning Rabbi Yehuda Bar Elai, he was one of the great teachers of Talmud, incidentally, and one of the great Hadoyim. Shehoyim Evatil Talmud Teril Hotzeres Hamesh Nachol Hotzeres Kala. He would fulfill this mitzvah of putting aside the study of Torah and also in order to escort a bride or in order to escort a dead person to the Beis Hamikdash. But they say, Bamed Devar Mavurim, when did he do that? He says, Kishe'en Shom Kol Tzorko, when there aren't enough people in order to do it. Then he would put it aside in order to do it. Aval Yesh Shom Kol Tzorko, but if there are plenty of people available in order to fulfill either these two mitzvahs that we mentioned, then in that case, Ein Mevatlin. So in that case, we did not put aside the study of Torah. So now the question is, what do we mean by a sufficient number? The Kabbat Salkora, how many do we need in order to fulfill this? So, you'll be amazed at the answer that they give. They said, if there are Tresar Alfei Gavrei Vishisa Alfei Shipurei, if there are 12,000 people who were there in order to escort them, and not only that, but also another 6,000 who are blowing shofar. The army law, but there are those who say, no, it's only Tresar Alfei Gavrei, right? 12,000 people. Uminaihu Shisa Alfei Shipurei. And among them, you find 6,000 shofar blowers. Okay. All right, good evening.
Good evening.
There's
a wire strung there. Yeah. We'll sit on it.
Okay, don't electrocute yourself over there. Chas v'shalom. Okay. So,
is this an impossible figure?
It's an exaggerated figure. No question about it.
In other words, you go to the funeral.
Go to the funeral, exactly. Go to the funeral, go to the chasana if you have the opportunity. However, according to the Shulchan Aruch, if there are at least 10 people available in order to carry on these things, then in that case, you don't have to go. But if there aren't 10 people, then you should be part of the minyan, okay, in order to escort it. Okay. You can take a look for a moment at the Tosfos at the top of the page on the left-hand column. It says, Vavatim tal b'torah tzuras habeis, right? He says, well, no kasha, he says, it's not a kasha, me'ahi the maseches derech eretz. From the story that we find in Derech Eretz, which happens to be what they call a minor tractate, okay? Tamridon, where they say, Masib Rabbi Akiva, it's a story about Rabbi Akiva, Shemotzo Meis Mitzvah. He found a Meis Mitzvah. Now remember what a Meis Mitzvah is. That is that there's nobody there in order to take care of that dead person, then it's your mitzvah to bury that person. Well, he found a Meis Mitzvah while he was on the road, when he saw Arbo Amilin, and he carried his dead body 4 miles. Ad shehevi yolaveis hakoros, until he brought it into the cemetery. Uchsheboa eitzel Rabbi Yeshua Rabbi Eliezer. Afterwards, he came to
the court.
So when he came to Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua, and Tosfos tells us, Sipa lehem, and he told them the story. Omulo, they said to him, Al kol p'tziyof tziyo shepesata. For every single step that you took, it's ki'ilu shafachta dam naki. It is as if you actually shed innocent blood.
Wow.
Hear what they say to him?
Yeah.
And they say to him, lo oyob ipnei she bitel yichudo. And it was not because he had set aside, you know, his learning. He stopped learning for the moment in order to take care of this mitzvah. Elo mishum, but rather shehezizu mimikovo. He moved his dead person from the place where he was lying. Umeis mitzvah keina mekoimei. We have a principle that says that umeis mitzvah, he acquires that spot in the ground which wherever he is. That's his property, and therefore that's where he should have been buried.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm telling you.
but this is just a tradition.
That's a story. I mean, well, obviously the idea is that Mes Mitzvah should be buried immediately in order to... this is the idea, okay? We've had cases of Mes Mitzvahs over here, but not people who died on the way. I mean, we've had people who let's say there were virtual Mes Mitzvahs. In other words, there's nobody, no family left, whatever, all alone, so you try to get a minion together in order to bury that person. I know, I mean, that Kadima has, from time to time, provided free burial to people who simply had no one at all. And, you know, cost money, I mean, because the grave diggers are not going to open up a grave unless you pay them their fee for it. But the shul has done it for several people.
Yeah.
Pardon me?
The Chevra Kedisha.
Yeah.
In many cases of people that we've been in Sahara.
Right, right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Either that or some just like a new, some of you kind of like the almost brand new immigrants.
Just watch out for the wire.
You're going to have a very...
I try to be silent.
You're going to have a very, very interesting...
More than you think.
I don't have to tell you.
All the synagogues donate. They don't just go to one.
No.
They'll go to each... It's not just Kadima.
You mean in turn. I mean, sometimes it'll be Kadima, sometimes B'nai Jacob or Bethel and so on. Oh, it's very nice.
Burial plot and rabbinical services,
right,
et cetera.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So it's good to know that the people are still carrying on this mitzvah. I don't have to tell you that in the Torah, taking care of a person who is dying, this is called a chesed shalemes, a true act of kindness to that person. Why? So Rashi explains that if you do a favor to somebody, eventually, I mean, that's a chesed too, but, you know, that might be repaid sometime, just as you helped him or her, so in turn they may help you, right? But chesed shalemes, I mean, that person can never repay you because, you know, he or she is gone. So that, therefore, it's considered a true act of charity on your part. All right, let's continue. All right, so as we see, Tosfos brings out the story simply to show what? Not only about the law of the Mes Mitzvah, but also to show that Rabbi Akiva was not being criticized by Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Eliezer, because he was mevatel Talmud Torah, because he was engaged in the mitzvah. So that therefore we see then that it is a mitzvah to help to be there to rejoice with the kallah or to escort a dead person, okay, and take care of the needs of a dead person. And but the other one obviously is a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, to have 12,000 people who are needed in order to be able to fulfill, if you have 12,000, or according to the other version, if you have 18,000 people, then you're excused from being the Vatal Talmud Torah. So obviously it doesn't hold. Yes.
I'm thinking of the famous writer who had 100,000 people turned out in New York for his funeral.
You're talking about Shalom Aleichem.
Was it Shalom Aleichem?
Yeah, it was Shalom Aleichem. Yeah, but there are others too.
Yeah.
I mean, and there is Israel, you know, Yerushalayim, also great Rabbonim, and Talmidei Chachamim have been buried over there. In some cases, they were brought from America in order to be buried over there. And thousands and thousands and thousands came
in order to be buried. From Moshe Feinstein.
Yeah, right.
Remember the reading it in the...
So people have come out for these things. You know, the secular public, they're amazed that so many people have come in order to show honor to a Talmud Chacham. Okay, so let's continue right now with the Gemara. All right, so that was one idea. Then Ula had a somewhat different idea as to
how many people are necessary in order to excuse a Talmud Chochem, in order to tell a Talmud Chochem that you're not excused from learning, but, you know, carry on with your learning. So he said, Kegon dechaitse gavri me'avula atzichon. He says, for example, if you have like a wall of people who are there from the city gate as far as the kever. Obviously, they didn't bury within the city grounds, they buried them outside. So if you have a wall of people like that, then in that case, you don't have to take care of it because they are already taking care of it. Rav Sheshes Omar, he said, Kinesina Soh, Kachta Tilasoh. He says, you know what? Just as the Torah was given, so likewise, when the Rabbeinu Shel Olam takes away the soul of the person who is the Talmud Chochem, it's the same thing. And he says, Manitzina Soh, Beshishim Riba, just as when the Torah was given, there were 600,000 men, you know, at the bottom of Mount Sinai in order to receive it. So after Tilasor, the Yeshishim Riba, that's what the Samach stands for, the Yeshishim Riba. So likewise, for a Leviathan, you should have 600,000 people. All right.
Well, I don't have to tell you. I mean, not everything in the Talmud is halacha in this particular case, but it shows you the tremendous importance, you know, which is being placed upon the fact that we should show honor to the dead and show honor at the same time to Chosin Kala by putting aside our learning in order to take part in the, whether it's the festivity of the Chosin Kala or whether it's the mourning for a person who has passed away.
Why Chosin and Kala require the same magnitude of mourning?
Well, they don't really. Okay. We're not talking practical halacha. We're talking, you know, the stress being placed upon how much respect do we have under these circumstances, you see. This is the basic idea. As far as the chosin kala is concerned, what is the minimum that they need? The answer is 10. You need a minyan. Right. It's not just bencher, you mean, but even under the chuppah, you know that when we recite blessings, there are actually two sets of blessings which are being recited. The first one is what we call Birchus Eretzin. This is the actual betrothal, engagement, whatever you want to call it, the real engagement, I mean, taking place, and that only consists of two brachas, Bori Pri HaGofen, and then Shevet Shevet Shevet, etc., etc. Okay, so that's, and then of course the chosin kala drink wine. Okay, then after that, what we normally do is to see what the chosin is giving to the kala is something of value, which of course, I mean, it's a ring in this case. I mean, this is our custom for centuries now. Although technically, he could probably give a wristwatch too and get by with it from a technical point of view. But, you know, we've been using a ring for a long, long time now, okay? And then after that, they always read the Ksuba. And then after the reading the Ksuba, then we have what we call the Sheva Brachas. Okay, so for Sheva Brachas, definitely you have to have a minyan. The first part maybe is legal without it. But Sheva Brachas cannot be done without a minyan being present. So, needless to say, we strive to have at least a minyan of people present at the wedding. But by the same token, for a Levaya, we try to have a minyan so that we could recite a Kaddish, because again, a Kaddish at the cemetery or any place, I mean, whenever we recite Kaddish, it requires a minyan. So that would be the minimum requirement, okay? Don't look for 600,000 people, okay?
In our religion, we really can't have just a couple being married in the rabbi's chamber by themselves, because
well,
it wouldn't be...
You're right. I wouldn't say that exactly, because with the Birchus Eretzin, and he gives her you know, value, an object of value, and he says, hurry out the Kodesh Sleeper, the Baal Zug, not which was who, or hurry out the Kodesh Sleeper, whatever it may be, okay? Mm-hmm. Then automatically they are husband and wife, okay? So from that point of view, you don't need a minyan. But of course, it would be stupid not to try to get a minyan, because you still want to have the Sheva Brachos that follow. And then, of course, you're right. I mean, for the meal, we again make Sheva Brachos at the conclusion of the benching. And for that, too, we need the minyan in order to say the Sheva Brachos.
There are tales, though, of the... in the Shtetlach, where the rabbi would hold a ceremony and he'd call his wife and his maiden to just to be there, somebody else in the room, you know, without... I've read such stories, without the...
Sabaisa, but I can only see it under the most dire circumstances. I mean, if, let's say something like, you know, happened, let's say, during the war or something, you know, that... and the women wanted to get married before they knew that they were going to be shipped off, or who knows what would happen to them. So in that case, they had emergencies. Right. There are times, I mean, where you've been to war for a real emergency. So it has to be a real emergency.
What then is the role of the ketubah if the bracha erusin really is the... that in a kenya is what
Kenyan.
Okay,
Kenyan. The other one, kenya, is you go to make you go shopping.
Well, all right, okay. Kenyan is fine. fine. Okay, that could be after. Right. The Kenyan, but if that and the Eris and the Kenyan really, in a sense, are the what contractually or legally makes the marriage. And what role does the ketubah have? Because they're signing the ketubah, and it's all, you know, better than I do how detailed it is.
Right. But the point is, I mean, from the point of view of, you know, the laws of marriage, I mean, you find in ketubah's kedushin and so on and so forth, that this was enacted in order to protect the Kedosh Yisrael, the Jewish women.
All right, okay.
And
right.
So therefore, right. You really have to... write, you know, a ketubah in order to make sure that, you know, in case chas v'sholem, if she's widowed, or in case, again, chas v'sholem, if you divorce her or something like that, you know, that she has at least something to live on.
And it's given into her hand.
Yes.
I also know, and one of the funny things, I'm sorry to waste your time. One of the interesting things when I had a stay for the bar exam, which is like came out of the blue, is that they're explaining about the laws of inheritance and intestacy and all this and whatever. And in Israel, still to this day, I don't know if it's ever really used, that a widow can choose not to get an intestate share, in other words, the share that would come to her by law from her husband's property, but it can choose as an alternate to take the sum mentioned in the ketubah.
Yeah, the only problem with that
is it's so little. I can't understand.
I mean, 200 zoos today, I wouldn't know what its value is.
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting.
Unless you figure out that once upon a time 200 zoos could buy this, that, and the other thing, and then what would be the equivalent sum today?
Also, the Sephardim
put
a lot in the ketubah.
That's correct.
I don't really, but it's just an interesting thing how
that. Yeah, that's what they call the Sefer Ketubah. In other words, you're permitted to add on to the ketubah financial arrangements. Okay.
Kiddushin or during the kiddushin before.
No, this is before the actual marriage takes place that you write a ketubah.
It's interesting. In our ketubah, there was an error found that we had to redo the whole contractual agreement without the minyan.
All right, I mean, that could be done without a minyan. That's right. If you discover a mistake in the ketubah, or chas v'sholem, let's say a ketubah gets lost. I mean, obviously, a woman who gets married is supposed to take good care of the ketubah.
How many edim are necessary?
You have to have two. But they have what they call a ketubah d'archisa, which means that in case a ketubah gets lost, so they will write another ketubah instead of not to replace it.
Oh.
Yeah.
How many
so for that, you don't have to have a minyan.
Right.
But you have to have, two edim in any case, in order to testify.
Is the ketubah signed and witnessed at the time of the tnoyim?
There is differences between what took place in Europe and what takes place in America today. Okay? Tanoim originally in Europe was held sometime prior to the wedding. Right. It could be a year, it could be a month, it could be whatever. It's okay. There's no definite time. But at the time of the Tanoim, they would write a document in which the two parties, that is, you know, the father of the chosen and the father of the kalim, okay, that they pledge that their children are going to get married on this and this date, right? And should they break it, then in that case, they have to pay what they call a knas. In other words, they have to pay a fine to the injured party, okay? So that used to be in Europe. Okay, in America what has happened is that in very few weddings, just prior to the writing of Ksuba, they have first of all the Tanoim, they write it, and then the two machatanisters, you know, the mother of the bride and the brother of the mother of the groom, they break a teller.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, that's the sign, I mean, that's the agreement, and then after that, then they sit down, they write the Ksuba, and proceed from that particular point.
Then they sign the
right.
Yeah,
so the next step with them would be the badekin, which means that the chosen puts the veil over the collar, and so on. Right.
What is a teller?
A plate.
It's
a plate. It's a Yiddish plate. Right. Okay. You'll forgive me if I use Yiddish words sometimes.
Okay, so then they can break a glass after at the end. So
they have a setting.
They've lost the whole setting.
Okay, anyway, on my side, let's get back to one text over here. Okay.
We learned a little extra Talmud.
Very good. Very important stuff, actually.
The fact is, I mean, the Talmud, whenever we study, you notice that they bring in a quotation from here, a quotation from there, and this is the way, you know, always bringing in material. Okay? All right. So now, the last thing that we said is that it's nice to have 600,000 people present at the Levaya, right? But they say, Hanimile, this would be true Leman Nikori Vitoni. In the case of a person who has studied Bible and has studied Mishnah, Avol Leman Namaste, but in the case of somebody who actually teaches Talmud or something like that, there is no limit as to how many people should come out in order to show honor. Okay. Tanya, we had another teaching that we had. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, there he says, "Bo urei, come and see, kama chaviven Yisrael fnei Hakadosh Baruch Hu. See how beloved the people of Israel are to the Rabbeinu Shalom. Shebechol mokem shegalu, shechino imohet. Wherever the Jews went into exile, God's divine presence also went into exile together with them. Golu l'Mitzrayim, when, for example, they were exiled into Egypt. Actually, this is what we're talking about in the days when you know, Joseph, Yaakov, Avinu, you know, that they left Eretz Israel, they went to Mitzrayim. So, Shechinu Mehem, we know that the divine presence was there with them. Shenemar, as there is a pasuk that we find in Shmuel Aleph, where it says, "Ha niglo niglesi leveis avicha b'yosem in Mitzrayim." The story over there is the story, if you remember, about Eli who took Shmuel, a young child, you know, under his wing, and so on. And then the Bible tells us that Eli HaKohen, unfortunately, had two sons who were a bunch of ganofim, okay? Hophni and Pinchas. They were not very nice people. Okay? So, Rabbeinu Shalom was upset about the kind, you know, and the fact that Eli never reproved them, and, you know, he did nothing to prevent them from carrying on what they were doing. So, at that time, the word of God came to Eli that said, "Surely did I not
literally reveal myself, deglazing. But remember that the word negler, which means to reveal oneself, also means to be revealed, or the root itself is golus, the same idea. They're all related. They're related from the root gimel vadete. Okay, so he says, surely I also went into exile. This is what the drasha is, right? And I was there, leves hodicha, for the household of your father. And of course, since Eli was a kohen, right? So naturally, who was his father? The answer is, it goes all the way back to Aaron HaKohen, right? So I revealed myself to Aaron HaKohen, the Yosef Mitzrayim, when they were still in Egypt. in what way do we know? Because the Rebbe Shalom told Moshe Rabbeinu when he was in Midian, go back to Egypt, and that his brother Aaron is going to come to meet him. So obviously Aaron must have had a divine message, you know, in order to go and to meet Moshe and escort him back to Egypt. Okay, so from this we learn then that the Shekhinah was exiled together with the Jewish people in Egypt. Okay, in other words, even though we were in exile, but God did not abandon us. His divine presence was there with us. And then Gola Bavavel, when they went into Golis in Babylonia, right? Shekhinah Imahem, then the Shekhinah also went together with them. Shenemar, as we find the Pasuk, which says in Yeshayahu, it says, Lamanchem Shilachti Bavela, for your sake I sent unto Babylonia. Now, this is what it says literally, but shilachti could also be understood as shulachti. For your sake was I also, as the Rebbe Shalom says, I was also sent into Babel. So, in other words, Rebbe Shalom accompanied us in Golis Babel. The Yavke Shehen Asidun Goel, and also when the people of Israel are destined to be redeemed, Shekhinah Mahem. Shekhinah will also be together with the people of Israel. Shenemar, as the Pasuk says, and this is the Pasuk that we find in the Devarim, okay? Parsha itself, if you find it, yeah. Anyway, it says over there, the Shav Adeshev Alekecha Esh Vuzcha, right? That the Rebbeinu Shalom will return together with your captivity. Literally, the translation over there is that the Rebbeinu Shalom will restore your captivity. But the point is, you know, that the word es in Hebrew has two different functions. One meaning of the word es is the one that we see most often, namely, it is the sign of the direct definite object, okay? But es also is a preposition which means with. When it's written, for example, at the beginning of Shmos, right? The Eile Shmos by Israel, by Mitzrayim, Eis Yaakov. It means that it came together with Jacob, right? Okay? So, Es very often means with, and of course, in that we have Iti, Itcha, Itach, etc. Okay? Together with me, and so on. Okay? So, in other words, the Rebbeinu Shalom is coming back together with your restored captivity to Eretz Israel, right? And as it says over here, the Heshev LeDemar, it doesn't say that the Lord will restore you, El Avishav, he himself will return. Malamech HaKadosh Baruch Hu Shovim Lehem Bein HaGoliyos. Right, it shows, right, that the Rebbeinu Shalom will return together with the people of Israel from the various exiles. Yes?
The immediate thought that comes to my mind is, God is every place.
Yes.
So when they say, "Will return," or God came with us, my concept of that is in connection with when we say, "Don't turn your face away from us,"
yeah,
or that He'll have His countenance to shine upon you.
Yeah.
So what it is more an awareness that God hasn't even in Golis, we are not forsaken.
That's correct.
But that God is with us.
Right, right.
That's the
absolutely.
That's the concept.
Certainly, that's
also
the idea that they want to say. God has not forsaken us,
exactly,
but He is with us, no matter what Golis is with.
All right. Well,
right.
That's
exactly
that's
what it is.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Well, let's see if we can get back on the track.
This is about Megillus
In other words, he served them, and the Caleb and Caleb showed them all different types of goblets, vessels, and so that they used over there. And we learned that he used.
Unkosher stuff.
Yeah.
But did the Jews ever get all these utensils back? I mean,
I don't think that they ever got them back. But they had to make new ones. They had to make new ones for the Beis HaMikdash, for the Beis HaMikdash was restored, so they had new ones.
But Doctor, when it says in Ezra that the king contributed, I forget, what's
he gave them money and other things, white coronas,
things from Kaveh, Beit Kodesh?
And he also gave animals for sacrifice and so on and so forth. That he did, right. But it doesn't say that, for example, he gave back the Caleb that was taken from the Beis HaMikdash. That doesn't say.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In many cases, I mean, things were buried even before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. I mean, like, for example, the Aron, the ark that was buried before him, because in the days of Yoshiyahu, the king, he knew that disaster was heading towards Israel. So they decided to bury it. Who?
King Solomon buried
him. No, he didn't. No, contrary, he started. He needed new stuff in the temple. Okay.
It is possible to assume that Vatican has all the Kelim from the Second Temple.
There is a possibility, right. Because the Romans, we know, they brought a good deal of the stuff back to Rome. And what has happened to it, we don't know, but one theory is that the Vatican took it from the Roman treasury once Christianity became the dominant religion. And they have a lot of stuff. We know that they have all kinds of manuscripts and other things and so on that were seized from the Jews, and that they have not really revealed to us.
You would think that they would know, because wasn't there two scholars that were working in the Vatican, and they were working with Jews?
Yeah, they're right. They finally gave permission to a couple of Jewish scholars to work, and then they denied them entry to certain parts of the Vatican Library. Right. They didn't want to give them permission. All right. Getting back over here to our text. Okay. Okay. Then Gemara asked the following question. Obviously, it was a question raised by scholars in Babylonia. It says, "Bibavel, in Babylonia, Echo, where exactly did the Shechina repose in Babylonia?" So Amar Abaye said, "I'll tell you where you can find where in Babylon. The Lake Nishta Duhutzel. You can find it in the synagogue in a community called Hutzel. Okay, over the Lake Nishta the Shofi Yasin in the Hardor, and in another shul is in the Hardor in the synagogue which is called Shofi Yasin. Some say that Shofi Yasin means that they ruined, they destroyed, and then they rebuilt." I'll read you what Rashi has to say about that. The Shofi Yosef, it's the end of the third line of the Rashi over there, where he says, Shofi Yosef says, "Uvna'o Yechonyo," says, "King Yechonyo built this shul in Ahardo." So it was Yechonyo the Siyato. So, of course, first of all, who was Yechonyo? He was the king who was exiled first by Nebuchadnezzar.
remember that in reality there were two Golis Bavels, approximately 11 years apart. Okay? One of them took place in about approximately the year 597 before the common era, when Nebuchadnezzar surrounded Jerusalem, and as part of the terms of peace, in order to let the city remain standing, so he took into exile the king of Yehuda, Yechonio, okay, or Yehoyachin, he's called by various names. So Konyo, he had different names, okay? And he was put into prison in Babylonia, and together with him were also exiled many, many thousands of the most prominent people in Yerushalayim and in the land of Yehuda. People who were leading scholars, people who were leading artisans, and so on. And then Nebuchadnezzar replaced Yehoyachin with Yehoyakim, who was the with Zedekiah, who was the last ruler of Eretz Israel prior to the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. He was put there as a vassal. He promised Nebuchadnezzar that he would remain loyal to him and would not engage in any conspiracy in order to rebel against Babylonia. And this was so for several years, but eventually there was a war party, number one, that said, let's fight for freedom, and number two,
out of Babylonia,
against Babylonia, gaining the freedom of Eretz Israel. There were still people living there in Eretz Israel, right. Okay. As I said, the temple was still in existence, okay? So this group of people, they wanted to fight for the freedom of Eretz Israel against the Babylonians. And at the same time, several of the surrounding nations, including Egypt, had told the Jews that if you fight, we'll join you in fighting against Babylonia. So you know what happened. Shas Mice, as we say, when it came to the actual event, so the Jews were left all by themselves fighting against Babylonia. And the other nations that had promised to work together with them, send troops and fight also, they all, what shall I say, chickened out. And the result was that the Jews fought for 3 years against Babylonia. But at the end of those 3 years, in the year 586, approximately before the Common Era, at that particular point, the city of Yerushalayim was destroyed, and you know, the Beis HaMikdash was burnt and so on, and then hundreds of thousands of Jews went to Babylonia. But what Rashi is telling us is that already in Golas Yehoyachin, when he was exiled